Hello and welcome to Power Problems. I'm John Glazer. My guest today is John Hoffman, foreign policy analyst at the Cato Institute and an adjunct professor at George Mason University. John, welcome back on the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
You've been writing quite a bit about U.S. policy in the Middle East, and in your latest piece, you argue for a fundamental reevaluation of the U.S.-Israel relationship. In fact, you say it's long past time for that. But before we delve into that specifically, I want to open with Gaza. You write, quote, "Israel's campaign of collective punishment in Gaza has been historic in scale." And there's two things I want to ask you about here. First, historic in scale. If you could explain to listeners the scale, but also collective punishment. That's a technical term in international law, and it'd be good if we understood its meaning.
Of course. So first, in terms of historic in scale, I think, you know, there's been a lot of great analysis by, you know, leading experts like Robert Pape and others showing that the level of civilian infrastructure being destroyed across the enclave, whether that be, you know, hospitals, schools, homes, before even getting into the death toll here, this is truly historically, at least in, you know, the past several decades, unprecedented. And, you know, they've been comparing this to the bombing campaigns, you know, during World War II in places like Dresden, you know, showing similar statistics in terms of the vast scale of destruction. So that's the first issue. Then looking specifically at, the term collective punishment, what we're seeing is across large parts of the strip is not, you know, Joe Biden himself has referred to the bombing campaign that Israel is currently undergoing as indiscriminate. And I think he's right, because what we've seen is a massive loss of civilian life. We've seen a targeting of civilian infrastructure, and we've seen a military campaign that is not exactly surgical, going after, you know, specific, you know, leaders of Hamas and things like that. But what we've seen is a broad punishing writ large of those living within Gaza. And, you know, that is, you know, what I try to highlight here in the piece, talking about, you know, we have just seen Gaza been, you know, brought to the brink of annihilation in the past 5 months.
You write that Israel has demonstrated no long-term political strategy in Gaza beyond the systematic destruction of the enclave and the killing of its inhabitants. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about military objectives here, or perhaps the lack thereof. And of course, there's news of an apparent plan by the Netanyahu government for some kind of attack on Rafah in southern Gaza along the Egyptian border. And Biden's been reportedly pushing back hard against those plans. What do you think the motive is for invading Rafah, and then like broader military objectives here? What can you discern?
Sure. So, you know, going to the first part of the question regarding, you know, what is this military campaign actually trying to do and what is it accomplishing? You know, Netanyahu from day one set out and said that his objective is, quote unquote, total victory over Hamas. From a military point of view, you can degrade Hamas. You can, you know, in the short term, eliminate its ability to do things like launch October 7, you know, 7 type attacks and so on and so forth, which is, of course, a laudable objective. You know, we don't want another October 7th. But at the same time, you cannot eradicate Hamas completely, whether militarily or politically. It remains interwoven within, you know, the politics of Gaza and the politics of Palestine and the Israel-Palestinian conflict more generally. Khaled Al-Gindi over at the Middle East Institute has done some really great work on this, showing, you know, these objectives that Netanyahu has laid out are virtually impossible. And looking specifically at, you know, I guess what's coming next is all indicators point to that Israel will continue to push into the city of Rafah despite U.S. objections, where more than 1.5 million Palestinians, this exceeds over half the population of the entire strip, have fled into Rafah. And, you know, what we've seen here is some bickering between Biden and Netanyahu publicly. You know, Biden spoke of a red line in terms of a possible military operation in Rafah, but then 2 seconds later, you know, turned around and said, oh, you know, the defense of Israel is still critical, so there is no red line. This incoherence on the part of the United States not only negates Biden's leverage, but it binds Washington to whatever policies Netanyahu decides to pursue. And, you know, from Netanyahu's point of view, you know, he and his far right coalition, they want to push into Rafah. You know, at least they've stated that they want to push into Rafah and to quote unquote finish the job. But if they launch a full scale invasion, ground invasion of Rafah, I think it's very plausible to perceive that this will be the worst part of what we've seen in the past 5 months, just because 1.5 million people are concentrated in this area.
At the top of this new piece that you've written in Foreign Policy, and we'll put it in the show notes, you write that, quote, Biden refuses to abandon the status quo, particularly regarding Washington's so-called special relationship with Israel. How would you describe this status quo that Biden doesn't want to budge from?
Sure. So, you know, for about 8 decades, there have been 2 foundational pillars of U.S. Middle East policy. One is this myth of authoritarian stability, this idea that Middle East autocrats, like from Saudi Arabia to the UAE to Egypt to Jordan, so on and so forth, are the best upholders of quote unquote stability and the best actors to advance U.S. interests in the Middle East. The other pillar of U.S. Middle East policy is unwavering support for the state of Israel. This has been a consistent pillar of U.S. Middle East policy since 1948. At the heart of this quote-unquote special relationship, which John F. Kennedy first referred to it as, at the heart of this is the unparalleled amount of aid that the United States has provided Israel. It's roughly $300 billion adjusted for inflation since World War II, and we continue to supply Israel with $3.8 billion annually in addition to other arms deals and security benefits. So when I say that Biden refuses to abandon the status quo vis-a-vis Israel or vis-a-vis the Middle East, I mean that he's continuing to reach for the same playbook that administrations over the past 8 decades, whether it be Republican or Democrat, have repeatedly reached for. And that, to me, you know, what I argue is a problem.
What does the United States get in return for this support of Israel?
No, and that's exactly, you know, what I'm trying to return this discussion back to is first order assumptions. You know, what has this subsidy that the United States is effectively providing Israel, what has this done for the United States? I argue that it has done very little for the United States while actively undermining our strategic interests, undermining the values that we claim to stand for. So, you know, in my piece, I argue that it's quote unquote, or it's time to quote unquote normalize the U.S. relationship with Israel, you know, trying to, you know, griff off the language of normalization and so on and so forth since the Abraham Accords. But I argue, you know, it's our subsidies for Israeli policies have insulated Israel from the cost of those policies. You know, what incentive does Israel face to change course when the most powerful state in the world refuses to condition its profound levels of political, economic, and military support? And, you know, why is the United States repeatedly dragged into supporting policies that are clearly against its interests?
You write that this support commands attention on both sides of the political aisle through different forms of direct lobbying and influence. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Sure. So what I mean by that is, you know, there's for years there have been, you know, those who are very pro-Israel, those who are very pro-America's deep engagement in the Middle East, who have poured a lot of money into DC, you know, whether it be members of Congress, whether it be think tanks, have poured a lot of money into academia to try and buttress these status quo policies and buttress this overall narrative. I remember when I was in my PhD program, we referred to it as systems of knowledge production that are, you know, designed to perpetuate the status quo. You know, so that's what I'm talking about in terms of these systems of direct and indirect influence. You have, you know, things like direct, straight up lobbying, and then you have other efforts to try and shape narratives, shape debates, so on and so forth, that takes America's deep engagement in the Middle East, that takes its unwavering support of Israel as a given, that doesn't even, you know, begin to challenge these assumptions.
Yeah, that's typically a very touchy sort of aspect of this issue. But I think sort of the general kind of political science understanding of it is, you know, different U.S. policy programs of all kinds get funding and support, and there are lobbyists pushing for this, that, or the other policy. It's kind of inherent in the democratic project.
No, of course.
It's not unique in Israel's case.
No, absolutely. And that's the thing. You know, it's not just Israel. We see this with Ukraine. We see this with Taiwan. We see this with other countries in the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia, the UAE. I mean, when you start counting the money that so many different countries across the world pump into Washington for favorable policies towards their own countries, I mean, it's just astronomical.
I want to ask you about the airlift policy that Biden has initiated. And I guess we're also deploying 1,000 troops to build a pier off the Gaza coast. There are layers of irony in being relegated to work around the intransigence of our supposed close friend and partner. Can you just explain the dynamics here and what this policy actually amounts to?
Sure. So, you know, this is the, you know, it would be funny if it wasn't so sad part of this article. But across, you know, like we've said, across the strip, we've seen civilian infrastructure systematically decimated. Starvation and disease are spreading rapidly. And the United States is claiming that not enough aid is getting into Gaza. So the situation now within Gaza is so bad that the United States, alongside other countries, France, Jordan, Egypt, are airlifting aid into the Strip. These airdrops of aid have actually killed numerous Palestinians. But the United States is also now deploying 1,000 troops to build a pier off the shore of the enclave in order to break this siege that its supposed ally, Israel, using U.S. weapons, refuses to lift. So, you know, it is quite ironic, as you point out.
You also talk about how Washington's unwavering support for Israel amid the war in Gaza has had disastrous regional ramifications. And I want to give you some time to discuss and explain the various regional consequences that we've seen.
Sure. So since October 7th, we have seen, you know, the region really go up. I don't know if go up in flames is the correct word, because it could get a lot worse. But what we've seen is escalation across the Middle East writ large. We've seen repeated daily skirmishes between Israel and Hezbollah on the border with Lebanon. Hezbollah recently launched, I think it was 100 missiles into Israel, and Israel responded by striking into Lebanon as far as Baalbek, which they haven't done since 2006 with its war with Hezbollah. In Iraq and Syria, we've seen since October 7th over 170 attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria, which has resulted in a tit-for-tat exchanges with various groups affiliated with Iran in these countries. We've seen 3 U.S. service members killed in Jordan by these groups. And then we've also seen the entrance of the Houthis into this conflict, and the Houthis being in Yemen, launching drones and other attacks against commercial and some U.S. military vessels in the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. So what we see is this kind of this arc of escalation, and all of this could quickly spiral out of control. You know, the U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria in particular, having come under attack 170 times, you know, should really raise the question of why are they there in the first place? You know, it's disrespectful to dangle our service members out there as bait. And then on the second hand, that they represent a dangerous tripwire for war with Iran. So at any moment, we could, you know, especially if Israel pushes into Rafah, these attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria have for the moment stalled. But if Israel decides to move into Rafah, we could expect these attacks to pick up once again. And, you know, it's a matter of time before we wake up to a headline of a mass casualty event involving U.S. troops, whether that be in Iraq, Syria, Jordan, off the coast of Yemen. I should also note, in addition to the three U.S. service members that died in Jordan, two U.S. service members, Navy SEALs, died trying to intercept weapons from Iran to the Houthis in Yemen. So five U.S. service members have already been killed as a part of this conflict. And amidst this, Israel has really tried to push the United States towards direct confrontation with Iran. Former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal saying, you know, it's time to take on Iran directly. So, you know, that, of course, I argue it would be very against our interests, but this is the situation that we find ourselves at.
We spoke earlier about the ways in which the United States supports Israel. We talked about money and weapons, but crucially, there's also diplomatic support, and that comes largely in the form of the U.S.'s veto power at the U.N. Security Council. And all your discussion about the regional ramifications, you know, it's not just that the conflict itself has riled things in the region. It's that, as you put it, Washington's unwavering support has kind of exacerbated all the regional ramifications, because we've repeatedly blocked, you know, an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. And if that had happened long ago, you might not have seen these reactions from the Houthis or the rest of these groups unfold, right?
The three UN resolutions that the United States blocked were, you know, in my opinion, didn't just have direct ramifications for what's happening on the ground in Gaza and in the Middle East, but this is also displaying a pretty glaring level of hypocrisy around the globe, undermining, you know, this, you know, supposed liberal world order that the United States is supposed to uphold, this rules-based order. And the most recent UN resolution that did pass, what we saw was it passed. It's a resolution that says there should be a drive for an immediate ceasefire for the month of Ramadan that ends in 2 weeks. But what we also saw with that is immediately after the United States, you know, came out and said, oh, well, this isn't binding or anything like that. So, again, what we see is kind of theatrics absent substance. And the United States, you know, by kind of using these hypocritical statements and so on and so forth, you know, you're sending mixed signals. Even if these, at the rhetorical level, if the United States did not come out afterwards and say this isn't binding, you know, Israeli Defense Minister Gallant is currently in Washington, D.C., or he was earlier this week, and he's requesting a slew of American weaponry. So if the United States decides to go through with that, then, you know, what message is that sending to Israel? What message is that sending to the world?
You also talk in the piece about how U.S. adherence to Israel's prerogatives tends to further militarize U.S. policy throughout the region, specifically with respect to Iran. Iran has long served as a kind of boogeyman that Israel can point to maintain U.S. support and distract from the Palestinian question. And you even write that Israel has been trying to, quote, pressure the United States into direct conflict with Iran. Can you talk about that question?
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of pressuring the United States into direct conflict with Iran, you know, first, this would be absolutely anathema to U.S. interests and regional stability. A war between the United States and Iran would be far more disastrous than the 2003 invasion of Iraq. This would destabilize the entire region. It would set the whole thing ablaze. But, you know, what we've seen over the past couple of years is Israel has tried to drive U.S. policy towards a more, confrontational direction with Iran. You know, you remember Netanyahu coming in 2015 to speak before Congress to rail against the JCPOA nuclear agreement. There were reports, you know, put out by, about how General Milley, you know, in the final days of the Trump administration had to essentially, you know, avert a war with Iran that Israel was trying to push Trump towards. And, you know, and like I just mentioned a few moments ago, you know, the piece put out by Naftali Bennett calling for, you know, the United States to take on Iran directly. We've seen that rhetoric mirrored by many politicians in the United States. You know, this is incredibly risky and you know, high-level military drills recently between Israel and the United States, Israel's recent attack on major gas pipelines within Iran, and this continued tit-for-tat escalation between Iranian-backed groups and the United States, you know, really risks sparking a region-wide catastrophe. But it doesn't seem that Washington is taking this into account.
Of course, it's also true that things like the Abraham Accords, which I'm going to ask you about in a second, you know, that involves a potential security guarantee and weapons, providing weapons to Saudi Arabia. You know, that's an example of militarizing U.S. policy in the region, basically on behalf of Israel. You write, the war in Gaza should demonstrate that trying to sidestep the future of the Palestinian people is a foolish strategy. I want you to expand on that, because a lot of people have argued, including you, that it's that approach that sort of puts the October 7th attack in context. You know, the Abraham Accords, a push to normalize relations between Israel and the Arab states, the dropping of all efforts to get a peace process going because basically Israel wouldn't negotiate. Talk about ignoring the core political dynamics at play and the consequences of that.
Sure. So what I'm getting at here is in terms of trying to sideline the Palestinian issue, trying to sideline Arab public opinion in general, you know, these were kind of the foundations upon which the Abraham Accords and this new, you know, drive for quote unquote peace were built upon. And in my analysis, I argue this is a losing strategy. This is a failed strategy because these issues are inherently political. You cannot bomb your way out of these issues. You cannot, you know, sideline and forcibly, you know, sideline these issues. But that's what the Abraham Accords and this whole new framework was kind of built around. It was that, you know, oh, for Arab autocrats, the Abraham Accords are a great way to stay tapped into Washington, D.C. by cozying up with Israel, to get all these unprecedented, you know, concessions in the process from, you know, major arms deals to, God forbid, a formal security guarantee for Saudi Arabia. And for Israel, this was a way to get the region's states and Washington more centered around, you know, a coalition to combat Iran to remain at the forefront of U.S. Middle East policy and to also sidestep the Palestinian question altogether. But what I argue is that the past 5 months should show that you cannot forcibly sideline this issue through military means. What happened on October 7th was horrible. At the same time, the past 5 months should show that the only way forward is a mutual peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Neither Israelis nor Palestinians will have security and peace until they both have it.
Going on from there, you mentioned in the piece that Biden has put forth a vision for bringing the conflict to an end, but also a pathway towards a Palestinian state. Do you want to tell me the content of those documents?
Sure. So, you know, we have two blueprints here, if you will. One is revealed, you know, was put out by Netanyahu. This really contains little more than a plan for the prolonged military occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. So pretty much just a guarantee for future instability, because, you know, it's just perpetuating the status quo. In contrast to this, the Biden administration's quote-unquote day-after blueprint includes a vision or a quote-unquote pathway for a Palestinian state. We've heard this a lot from the administration about a pathway towards a Palestinian state. Not, you know, they've been pretty clear. They're not demanding an upfront declaration or establishment of a Palestinian state, but instead a pathway. But these plans, there's no concrete plan, and I would argue much less intent, for the implementation on the part of the United States or Israel for this quote-unquote pathway. And it seems like this hat tip, this rhetorical commitment to a pathway is more designed to push through Biden's primary objective, which is Saudi-Israel normalization. And because the Saudis have said that they will not normalize until there is a quote-unquote pathway to a Palestinian state. Now, what that pathway looks like, whether it's realistic, whether anybody intends to implement it, is a completely different question. But this is ultimately what Biden is pushing for, is Saudi-Israel normalization. And, you know, it is this component, this Palestinian component that Biden is trying to hash out to make this acceptable to the Saudis, to, you know, somehow, you know, get the Israelis on board, even though Netanyahu has been adamant about his opposition to a Palestinian state. So, but at the end of the day, this is, you know, Biden trying to maneuver to push through his quote unquote grand bargain in the region.
I wonder, if we can take the Middle East analyst cap off and sort of think about U.S. politics, maybe I can get you to speculate a little bit about how things are going and the trajectory. You know, you've talked about how Biden has pretty well stuck to the status quo, but there do seem to be some changes in U.S. politics on the Israel-Palestine question. You know, Chuck Schumer, the Senate majority leader, recently made a big speech criticizing Israel, in particular the Netanyahu government. That was seen as a major thing. I wonder if you can just kind of talk about the gradual shift in the politics here.
Yeah, you know, the Schumer speech was really unprecedented. You know, and what we've seen in the United States, you know, really over the past 5 months, we've seen a lot of polling in the United States done. We've seen that the majority of Americans favor a ceasefire. Gallup put out a poll, I think just yesterday, saying that a majority of Americans disapprove with how Israel is handling the war in Gaza. We've seen also, you know, a couple weeks ago, we've seen in primary votes, you know, in places like Michigan in particular, we've seen a lot, you know, of frustration vented, you know, by people voting uncommitted and so on and so forth in order to voice their protest to Biden. So we see domestic dissatisfaction, if you will, with how Biden is handling this issue. And, you know, if I'm Biden's team, if I'm seeing this, if I'm seeing these polls, if I'm seeing these uncommitted votes, if I'm seeing all of this, alarms should start going off at some point saying, you know, this might not bode well for me in November. So, you know, I think we are seeing a shift among the American populace. Whether that is going to be mirrored by elites in Washington remains to be seen. And whether that discontent does translate into people adjusting how they're voting or whether they vote in November also remains to be seen. But like I said, if I'm the Biden team, you know, some red flags should be starting to go up around me.
You argue that basically this special relationship with Israel doesn't do anything for the United States, and it undermines our interests. and often does violence to the values that Washington claims to stand for. What would a more normal, or as you say, normalized approach to Israel look like?
Right. So a more normalized approach to the U.S.-Israel relationship is exactly that. It would just be a normal relationship. This does not in any way, shape, or form mean making Israel an enemy of the United States, but rather approaching Israel the same way that the United States should approach any foreign nation. And that's from arm's length and based solely on U.S. national interests. No longer would decisions about military aid, arms sales, diplomatic cover, whatever, be rooted in this path dependency or muscle memory or reflexive action, but rather on the perception of the U.S. or of U.S. interests at stake. So, you know, I would argue that instead of enabling, shielding, or subsidizing Israeli policy, the United States would reorient its relationship with Israel on the basis of concrete U.S. interests. And this would entail just regular give and take in negotiations that you see with U.S. treaty allies like Japan or South Korea. You know, so when I say it's time to quote unquote normalize the U.S.-Israel relationship, it means exactly that. Just make it a normal relationship between two sovereign nations.
So a more normal or normalized approach to Israel might be forthcoming given the changes in U.S. politics sometime in the future. But for right now, Biden is still, as you put it, stuck on the status quo. And that includes regionally, despite how much criticism the Abraham Accords and the attempt to normalized relations with Saudi Arabia and Israel, despite how much criticism that's received post October 7th, it appears that that's still the Biden administration's approach. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say that's exactly correct. Biden's strategy on October 6th is no different than his strategy on October 7th or October 8th or today. You know, it remained consistent. And what that strategy is trying to reach this quote unquote grand bargain with Saudi Arabia that sees Saudi Arabia normalize relations with Israel. And the Biden administration has cast this as a way to preserve a two-state solution, as a way to balance against Iran and preserve overall regional stability, as a way to counter China in the long term. I mean, this thing has really been cast as a way to do everything aside from curing AIDS, which, you know, would be great if it was that easy, but it's really not. You know, this deal that the United States is trying to reach would witness unprecedented concessions granted to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, namely a formal security guarantee and cooperation with a civilian nuclear program. Both of these, I think, on their face should, you know, be self-explanatory on why they're against U.S. interests. But really at the heart of what this agreement and what the accords more generally have produced is a further U.S. commitment to the underlying sources of regional instability. So a formal security guarantee would quite literally formalize and cement our commitment to these sources of instability, and this will undermine U.S. interests and regional stability for generations.
Well, on that happy note, John Hoffman, thanks again for coming on the show.
Of course. Thanks, John.